They Katra podcast conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome, curious minds. Today, we are strapping in, really, for a deep dive into, well, the cosmos itself. We're looking at the foundational work of David A. Rothery on planets.
Yeah.
If the solar system you learned about in school feels a bit dusty, get ready. Decades of exploration have, like, completely rewritten the textbooks.
That's absolutely right. Our mission today, really, is to give you that modern upgrade. We're going to unpack how space probes, you know, robotic missions, have just revolutionized our understanding
of everything out there.
Everything, from Mercury way out to distant exoplanets. And crucially, we'll explain why this radically new perspective is, well, it's the only way to truly appreciate and maybe even protect our own world, Earth.
Yeah, that connection back home is key. And the core insight Rothery delivers is that planets aren't these sort of passive, static points of light we used to imagine.
Not at all.
They are dynamic, they're evolving, they're interconnected systems, and we understand them best now through something called comparative planetology.
Right. Looking at them side by side.
Exactly. Studying them together to figure out the universal laws at play.
And we promise some pretty high-impact takeaways right away. We're going to explain, using the actual data, why Pluto had to be reclassified, you know, that whole debate.
Oh, yeah, everyone remembers that.
And why maybe the ultimate search for life has kind of shifted away from looking for a second Earth and moved toward the cold, dark, icy moons way out in the outer solar system. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
So to lead us through this whole revolution in thinking, we need someone who isn't just, you know, reading about the science. We need someone actually doing it.
Absolutely.
And David A. Rothery is perfect. He's a professor of planetary geosciences at the Open University. I mean, that makes him an incredibly credible guide.
And what really gives his work such authority, I think, is that he's not just sitting in a lecture hall theorizing. He is actively involved in space missions, like boots on the ground, metaphorically speaking.
Exactly. Hands-on experience.
He's heavily involved with the European Space Agency's work. Specifically, he's the UK lead for the MIX-S instrument. That's the Mercury Imaging X-ray Spectrometer on the BepiColombo mission, heading to Mercury right now.
Yeah, so that hands-on experience means he writes with this real insider's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
He knows the practical challenges, the excitement of the really cutting-edge discoveries.
Right.
And what's distinctive, I find, is that he comes at this as a geologist first.
Hmm. Tell me more about that.
Well, he looks at planets and moons primarily as complex systems of rock and ice and atmospheres, the actual materials.
That focus on the stuff.
Right.
The rocks, the ices, the gases. That's fascinating. It forces you to look past just, you know, orbits and gravity and into billions of years of material history.
It does.
But does approaching it mainly as a geologist maybe risk, I don't know, understating other aspects, like atmospheric physics or orbital mechanics?
I don't think so. Not really. It actually feels like the perfect balance because, you know, geology is the physical foundation. It kind of dictates everything else that happens on a world.
Okay, that makes sense.
And his teaching background really shines through. He's exceptional at taking these complex geological ideas like plate tectonics here, or why Mars doesn't have it, and making them incredibly clear. He bridges that gap between the, you know, the hard science and public understanding just beautifully.
Okay, so let's get into the central thesis of his work then. It's basically an argument to, like, toss out that simple pastel diagram of the nine planets you probably had on your wall as a kid.
Right. Forget that neat little picture.
Our understanding of how planets form, how they evolve, the sheer variety out there, it's been fundamentally upended by data, real observations.
The book just dismantles that simple linear model and replaces it with a picture that's dynamic, it's nuanced, and frankly, it's wonderfully weird.
Mm.
The journey sort of kicks off with the most contentious issue, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
How to even define a planet, that whole Pluto thing.
Right. Starting with the controversy.
And then it moves logically into explaining the origin of the entire solar system. The nebular hypothesis,
yeah.
How it all got started.
And from that origin story, we basically embark on this grand tour.
Yeah.
The scorching inner rocky worlds, then the massive gas and ice giants further out, the small, surprisingly active bodies in the, you know, the far reaches.
Like Pluto itself.
Exactly. Before leaping into the truly wild diversity of exoplanets orbiting other stars.
So the overarching question Rothery is really tackling is pretty foundational. What does modern planetary science, fueled by all these robotic missions, actually tell us?
About planets themselves.
Yeah, about their nature, about our solar system's history, and ultimately about our own place in the cosmos. His goal seems to be giving you that powerful foundational knowledge, but without, you know, burying you in jargon, making it accessible.
Okay, so before we even look at how planets form, we have to agree on what one is. And that means facing that one controversy that really grabbed everyone's attention back in 2006, the reclassification of Pluto.
Right. And that decision by the International Astronomical Union, the IAU, it wasn't made out of spite or because astronomers suddenly disliked Pluto.
No.
It happened because new discoveries were challenging the old categories. It proved science is, you know, a living, breathing thing. It adapts.
So they needed a stricter definition.
Exactly. A rigorous definition. And it came down to three main criteria.
Okay, the first two were pretty easy for Pluto, right? It has to orbit the sun.
Check.
And it must be massive enough for its own gravity to pull it into a nearly round shape, that state called hydrostatic equilibrium.
Check again. Pluto does that. But here's the crucial third point, the one Pluto failed.
This is the big one.
The object must have cleared the neighborhood around its orbit. We often gloss over that part, but it's key.
What does clear the neighborhood actually mean in practice?
It means a true planet has to be the gravitational boss of its orbital zone. Mm. It has to have either sucked up or kicked out all the other large bodies in its path over billions of years.
Ah, okay. Gravitational dominance.
Precisely. And Pluto simply doesn't do that. It shares its orbital space with countless other large objects out there in the Kuiper Belt, these trans-Neptunian objects.
Like Eris, wasn't that one of them?
Exactly, Eris.
Yeah.
Which, even slightly more massive than Pluto. Finding things like Eris forced the IAU to basically say, look, Pluto isn't unique in failing that third test. It's just the biggest, most famous member of this whole new class of objects, the dwarf planets.
Right. So it defined a new category, really.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So once we've sort of defined what a planet is, we have to tackle how we actually build one.
The origin story.
Yeah, the cosmic origin story. And this takes us to the nebular hypothesis, which describes how our whole solar system got started about, what, 4.6 billion years ago?
Right. This massive cloud of gas and dust collapsing under its own gravity.
Yeah, it collapses. And as it collapses, it starts to spin faster, flattens out, kind of like pizza dough.
Yeah.
Into this spinning quotoplanetary disk.
Okay.
And that's where the action happens. Little bits of dust stick together. Gravity pulls more stuff in. You get bigger clumps into planetesimals. But where those clumps formed, that determined everything about their future.
Location, 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 even in space.
Absolutely. And that everything is defined by one critical invisible boundary.
Mm.
The frost line. Sometimes called the snow line.
Okay. The frost line. What is that?
It's not the physical line you can see, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
It's the distance from the young sun, where it was cold enough for volatile compounds, things like water, ammonia, methane, to condense into solid ice crystals.
Ah, so inside that line closer to the sun, it was too hot for ice.
Exactly. Too warm. Inside the frost line, only materials with really high melting points, like rock and metal, could solidify into grains.
Which means the building blocks there were relatively rare.
Right. So you could only form smaller, denser planets.
Yeah.
Our terrestrial planets. Mm-hmm. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. Made mostly of rock and metal.
But outside the frost line.
But step outside that line, into the colder regions, and suddenly you have way more solid material available because all that water ice could form. Ice was incredibly abundant compared to rock and metal.
So the baby planets out there had much more material to grow from.
Tons more. It allowed the protoplanets out there, the cores of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, to grow massive, incredibly quickly, much faster and much bigger than the inner planets.
And once they got big enough?
Once they got big enough, maybe 10 Earth masses or so, their gravity was strong enough to start pulling in huge amounts of the hydrogen and helium gas that made up most of the original nebula.
Ah, so they vacuumed up the gas.
Yeah, they captured these vast, deep atmospheres leading directly to the colossal gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn, and the somewhat smaller ice giants, Uranus and Neptune, which have more ice mixed in. That frost line is fundamental.
That really clarifies the basic structure. Okay, so that brings us to comparative planetology in action, looking at these worlds side by side. When you look at the rocky inner worlds, I mean, they're a terrifying lesson in climate sensitivity, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Take Venus.
Earth's evil twin.
That's the one. Similar size, similar composition to Earth, but its surface. I mean, it's hot enough to melt lead. over 460 degrees Celsius.
Just unbelievable. And that's the greenhouse effect gone wild.
Completely wild. A runaway greenhouse effect. And this is the profound power of comparative planetology. That single data point, Venus, it just proves that being slightly closer to the sun or maybe having slightly different early geology doesn't just make a planet a bit warmer. It could push it over a tipping point into a fundamentally uninhabitable state.
It's a stark warning.
That sensitivity, that potential for runaway feedback loops. It's a terrifying lesson in how fragile planetary climates, including our own, can truly be.
Then you look the other way, at Mars. The focus there is so much on its past, isn't it? Its potential for life back then.
Exactly. All our rovers and orbiters, Curiosity, Perseverance, AVN, they've delivered just compelling evidence. Ancient river channels, dried up lake beds, minerals that only form in water.
Right. Clear signs of water.
Clear signs that Mars was once significantly warmer and wetter. It might have supported vast lakes, maybe even a shallow northern ocean, billions of years ago.
So the ongoing search there is really for signs of past microbial life, fossils in the rocks.
That's the prime directive, essentially. Looking for biosignatures preserved from that early, potentially habitable era.
Okay, but then, here's where the story takes that twist you mentioned earlier. The search for current life gets flipped on its head.
Yeah, completely. When we look at it, the giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, the real excitement now, astrobiologically speaking, isn't their swirling atmospheres or those spectacular rings. It's their moons, specifically the icy moons.
Right. You mentioned Europa orbiting Jupiter and Enceladus orbiting Saturn. Why are these cold, icy little worlds suddenly the prime targets, beating out even Mars for potential current life?
Because the missions, particularly Galileo at Jupiter and Cassini at Saturn, gave us staggering evidence that both of them likely possess subsurface liquid water oceans.
Liquid water oceans beneath the ice.
Deep beneath their icy crusts. Global oceans, potentially holding more water than all of Earth's oceans combined, especially in Europa's case.
But how? They're so far from the sun, it must be incredibly cold out there.
It is. They don't need the sun to keep that water liquid. They're heated from within by something called tidal heating.
Tidal heating. Okay, I've heard the term, but how does that actually work? Is it like tides on Earth?
Sort of, but way more intense. Think of it like constantly squeezing and flexing a stress ball. As these moons orbit their massive parent planets, Jupiter or Saturn, they aren't in perfectly circular orbit.
Right, they're usually a bit elliptical.
Exactly. So the immense gravitational pull from the giant planet varies slightly as the moon moves closer and farther away. And other nearby moons also tug on them. This constant variation in gravitational pull stretches and squeezes the moon's interior. All that flexing generates immense friction, which creates heat. Intense geothermal heat deep inside.
Ah, so the planet's gravity is literally kneading the moon's insides, generating heat.
That's a great way to put it, kneading the insides. And that internal heat is enough to maintain liquid water deep down, potentially for billions of years, completely independent of sunlight.
Wow, that completely expands the whole idea of a habitable zone, doesn't it?
Dramatically.
Yeah.
It means potential habitats for life might exist in places we never imagined, far from any star's warmth.
Okay, let's try and synthesize some of this, because this material isn't just cool astronomy facts. It has, like you said, real resonance back here on Earth. What are the core themes Rothery really leaves us with?
I think there are three major themes that really provide maybe a humbling perspective. First is just the sheer scope of planetary diversity.
All those exoplanets.
Yeah. The discovery of thousands of exoplanets, worlds like hot Jupiters orbiting incredibly close to their stars, super Earths bigger than our planet. It just shattered the assumption that all solar systems would basically look like ours.
So the link back to real life is?
It proves that nature's imagination is just far greater than ours. We have to keep an open mind in science and maybe just in general. Expect the unexpected.
That's a good one. Okay, second theme.
The second is the method itself, comparative planetology. We touched on Venus and Mars, but the principle is key.
Studying worlds side by side.
Exactly. By studying the scorching of Venus and the freezing drying out of Mars, we gain these invaluable insights into the stability and maybe the ultimate fragility of Earth's own climate and geology.
It puts Earth in context.
Precisely. It shows us that Earth isn't some default setting. It's just one data point in this vast cosmic experiment. We learn about Earth by looking elsewhere.
And the third theme.
And finally, it's that technology is the engine of discovery. Almost everything we've talked about, the oceans of Europa, the nitrogen glaciers on Pluto, those thousands of exoplanets, it all comes from robotic explorers.
Missions like Kepler, New Horizons, Cassini.
Exactly. Without them, we'd still be guessing. It's a powerful argument, I think, for continued investment in curiosity-driven science. The breakthroughs often come from places you weren't even looking.
Yeah, that's undeniable. And the book, or Rothery's work generally, seems full of these ideas that just fundamentally shift your perspective, like little knowledge bombs that stick with you.
Absolutely. Like that realization about the whole planet definition thing.
Yeah.
The definition of a planet is not a fact of nature waiting to be discovered, but a human classification created for our convenience.
Mm. That really highlights how science works, doesn't it?
It shows that the rules of science adapt to new evidence. They aren't written in stone. They're tools we create and refine.
Or this one, which feels like the heart of Rothery's geological method. To truly understand the Earth, we must study the other planets. In the scorched plains of Venus and the frozen deserts of Mars, we find powerful lessons about our own world's past and potential future.
That's it right there. That's the ultimate justification for spending billions on space probes. It's about understanding ourselves.
Yeah.
And my personal favorite, which sums up this whole new era of astrobiology, the search for life is no longer confined to looking for a second Earth. The discovery of potential liquid water oceans within icy moons forces us to imagine life thriving in environments utterly alien to our own.
Moving beyond the Goldilocks zone idea.
Way beyond it. Thinking about life based on chemistry, not just sunlight.
So if we bring those big cosmic lessons back down to Earth, what are some of the really practical applications for, you know, the person listening right now? How does this knowledge actually help us?
Well, I think the most immediate and maybe most important one is deepening environmental awareness.
How so?
Seeing Venus's runaway greenhouse effect laid out, not as a political talking point, but as hard planetary physics. It provides this stark, undeniable scientific basis for understanding and protecting Earth's climate stability.
It grounds the climate discussion in something concrete, something observed elsewhere.
Exactly. It shows what can happen. It's planetary physics, not politics.
You mentioned Venus showing tipping points earlier. Can you elaborate on how that grounds the discussion scientifically beyond just it gets hot?
That's right. It's crucial. Venus isn't just warmer. Its climate system entered a feedback loop it couldn't escape. Thick CO2 atmosphere trapped heat, which released more CO2 from rocks, which trapped more heat.
A runaway cycle.
A truly irreversible runaway state. So Venus serves as this scientifically documented example of what happens when a planet's climate system goes past a critical threshold.
Mm.
It's not just theory. It's a planetary cautionary tale proved by observation and modeling.
That's powerful. Okay, what else?
On a more personal level, it definitely helps in fostering a cosmic perspective. Understanding the immense scale, the vastness of time, the sheer diversity of worlds out there.
Yeah.
It can genuinely make everyday terrestrial conflicts seem, well, incredibly small and maybe a bit petty. It encourages a greater appreciation for just how unique and precious life is here on our pale blue dot, as Sagan called it. And maybe fosters a sense of shared humanity.
Hmm. A dose of perspective is always good.
And finally, I think the whole body of work really enhances scientific literacy. It doesn't just give you cool facts about space. It shows how science actually works.
The process.
Yes. Hypotheses are formed. They're tested by mission data. Theories get refined or sometimes completely overturned based on evidence. Learning that process is vital for critical thinking, for engaging with any complex information in the modern world, whether it's about a distant star or a local policy decision.
That's a great point. Okay, wrapping things up, what surprised you most in revisiting Rothery's work and this whole new view of the solar system?
For me, I think it really was the transformation of Pluto.
Oh, yeah.
Going from being seen as this, you know, simple, boring, inert ice ball at the edge of everything to what the New Horizons mission showed us, this incredibly dynamic, geologically active world.
With mountains and glaciers.
Yeah, mountains made of water ice as hard as rock, vast plains of flowing nitrogen ice behaving like glaciers. It just hammers home that the complexity we thought might be unique to the inner solar system could be hidden absolutely everywhere, even in the coldest, darkest fringes.
That's amazing. For me, I think the most valuable lesson, the thing that really sticks, is just the sheer excitement that we are absolutely living in a golden age of exploration. right now.
No question.
That profound question, are we alone? It's moved out of philosophy and science fiction and become a truly testable scientific hypothesis.
With active missions designed to find clues.
Exactly. And the answer, if we find one, might not be found in sunlight on a Mars-like world, but deep down in the dark, tidally heated oceans of a moon like Enceladus or Europa.
That shift in where we're looking and how we're looking is truly profound. It changes everything.
So, as a final provocative thought for you, the listener, to chew on, just consider the implications of finding life that thrives without photosynthesis.
Life in total darkness.
Yeah. Life that relies instead on chemosynthesis energy from chemical reactions or maybe geothermal heat from tidal forces. How utterly alien, how fundamentally different might that life be from anything we've ever conceived of? What would its rules be?
Something to ponder.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.